Hey guys, it's Thano. Welcome back to The Greek Current. Here with Georgia Logothetis.
Hello, everybody.
And a new voice to the podcast, Nick Vazdakis, one of our Leadership 2030 fellows and a longtime advocate now on Hellenic issues. Welcome, Nick.
Yes, thank you.
We need to have some type of initiation thing here every time we get somebody new on the podcast, you know, some type of mini hazing ritual. Safe. I'm not talking binge drinking, but we need something every time we have a newbie on the podcast. So welcome, Nick.
Yeah, we'll have Nick work up a plan for that, and then
it could be part of his Leadership 2030 homework.
Yeah,
I'll circle back. I'll circle back with you guys tomorrow. No, I'm happy to be here and happy to join in on the conversation. Longtime listener of the podcast, so happy to contribute as always.
No, it's great to have you. I want to start off with a conversation about our philanthropy day that took place this week on Wednesday in Chicago. Nick, tell us a little bit about what the day was.
Sure. So we partnered with various restaurants in Chicago and New York, and they pledged to give a portion of their profits from people that dined in, essentially to donate to the cause in the wildfire crisis that's going on in Greece right now. And so, you know, a lot of us kind of came together and, you know, we had a great meal. In Greektown here in Chicago, we had a big table and some other folks organized more tables as well. So, you know, just doing our part and trying to contribute and, you know, why not make it fun while you're doing it as well, right?
Exactly. And I think that the response, especially from the community, has been amazing to our campaign to provide relief for the wildfires in Greece. Whether it's the individual donations online or the work that the restaurants have done to raise these funds as well by opening up their doors and providing a percentage of their profits has been heartwarming. And there's some great stories, especially when we talk about, we heard some amazing responses from already trickling in of, you know, waiters giving up their portion of their tips, for example, mm-hmm. to contribute out of generosity because they felt so moved that they wanted to participate in this this effort.
Yeah, big shout out to the waiters over at Greek Islands. The restaurant donated a portion of its profits, but they went and donated their tips for the entire day. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a measure of solidarity, made a huge bump in our fundraising efforts. So from all of us at HALC, a huge thank you to each one of them for their generosity, their philotimo. So we had our day of philanthropy in Chicago, in the Chicagoland area, with six restaurants. And we have raised, I think, over $185,000 on the actual GoFundMe mm-hmm. page.
Yes.
So this is excluding the individual donations that you'll see on that GoFundMe page. So this will be added to that total to go towards our $250,000 goal. Nick mentioned New York. That's actually taking place on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you are in the New York area, I highly recommend you call in and make a reservation at Nerai Restaurant in Manhattan. They will be donating every dollar spent will be going towards the wildfire relief campaign.
It's amazing.
So a big shout out to our member out there, Spiro Menegatos.
Yeah, one of New York's premier restaurants. If you've ever been there, I mean, it's in a state of its own, right? The quality of the food, the hospitality, the service, and now you know that when you go in and you have this great, delicious meal, that they're donating every dollar that mm-hmm. comes in the door to this relief campaign. So,
And on a Saturday,
exactly. On a Saturday in New York, in Manhattan, donating every dollar of proceeds. So a huge thank you to them and their generosity as well.
Yeah, and the response hasn't been limited to the Greek community at all. We've seen a number of donations that, as we've been monitoring the GoFundMe, from our neighbors in our communities, in our neighborhoods that have stepped up, heard about it from us, or seen it in the ad that we placed in the Chicago Sun-Times, mm-hmm. online, just by sharing it on Facebook and Twitter. Mm-hmm. It reaches a lot of people, and people really feel a connection to Greece. And looking through the comments, at least on the GoFundMe, you find some really moving statements, and you realize that there's so many people that view Greece as much more than just, you know, a place on a map.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of these people have personal experiences. You'll see on the GoFundMe page, they'll say, we traveled to Greece, you know, 10 years ago. It was mm-hmm. one of the best places we've ever been to. And we have donations from 48 different countries, just to give you a sense of the scope of this campaign. So 48 people in 48 different countries across the globe heard about this campaign, went online and donated what they could. So the outpouring of support has been just phenomenal. And individually, we want to make sure that we thank every single, if you're listening to this podcast and you donated, a very heartfelt thank you from HALC headquarters, and obviously from everybody over at Chicago Cities International Athens Committee as well.
We'll be updating you all as we get the numbers coming in from the restaurants that have partnered with us. I know this isn't going to be the last time, hopefully, that we'll be able to work together with the community on a broader scale to raise funds until we hit our goal and even move past it. So stay tuned for new initiatives.
And I also want to still trying to hit that goal. So if anyone's listening and has not donated yet, we'll share a link in the show notes in the podcast below. So please donate, and so we can hit that $250,000.
Yeah, and if you the donation link is HellenicLeaders.com/HelpGreeceNow. And I also want to point out that the first amount of money, Georgia, has been dispersed, actually.
Yeah, well, it's on the way to being dispersed. Yeah, so the first batch of funds, about $50,000, is on its way to being dispersed. And it's one of the things that has been a hallmark of our advocacy is accountability to our donors. And so that's something that we wanted to really make sure before we release the first batch of funds that we have, you know, the proper channels for it, the proper responsibility on the ground, and most importantly, a feedback loop so that you as a donor know what happened with your funds. So so that first $50,000, it's on its way to Greece, and we will report back to you exactly where it went and how it's being spent and how it's helping the people who are unfortunately dealing with the aftermath of this horrific tragedy.
Yeah, so that, I think that wraps up our conversation on the Day of Philanthropy. If you haven't donated, head over to our website, HellenicLeaders.com/HelpGreeceNow, and see if you're able to make a donation. Share the page again. If we keep sharing it, it stays in the front lines of the news. I want to move on to some different breaking news. I know we're going to have an interview on our podcast this week with turkey expert Michael Rubin, but given that the interview was recorded on Thursday, we weren't able to discuss some of the breaking developments that have taken place relating to the sanctions that the United States imposed on Turkey. Nick, I know you've got some figures on that.
So today, right before we recorded this podcast, there was some breaking news that Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, met with Turkey's foreign minister in the Southeast Asia Conference in Singapore. And, there's some quotes coming out of that meeting. Mike Pompeo apparently had noted that the clock had run out on Turkey in terms of the detaining of Pastor Brunson. And so, one thing we've noted in recent, times now is the Pastor Brunson issue has really brought Turkey and its bad acts to the forefront here. And so you can see, Mike Pompeo talking to him. They had a meeting, which was apparently constructive. However, the Turkey's foreign minister did state that that he opposed the rhetoric or the threats that are coming from the current U.S. administration.
What they call the threats.
Right. So they're calling them threats. The sanctions, obviously, he's opposed to those. But, he said that they wouldn't back down in light of the sanctions and the threats. So.
And we heard from Turkey, too, that they were going to react. One news article had a quote with hostility. Georgia, what are some of the ways that what are some reactions that we've seen? I know.
Yeah, there was one circulating on Twitter about how calling on Erdogan to seize Trump Tower in Istanbul as retaliation. Which, as an aside, this goes to show you why it's so important for elected officials and especially the president to divest interests. The mere fact that somebody can threaten to seize the president's business interests is a huge reason why we have an emoluments clause in the Constitution and the reason why we say that you can't benefit financially off of, being president. In any event, that's not going to happen. But what is going to probably happen, Turkey's going to dig its heels in. This is what they do. Mm-hmm. Do they care about the sanctions? Honestly, no. I don't think so. And in the long run, it's not like these two individuals have massive amounts of property or funds in the United States that can't be easily substituted by stuff in the Turkish coffers, right? So this is more just their, it gives them fodder to say that, well, the Americans are anti-Turkey, you know, which they've been feeding to their mm-hmm. populace for decades now.
And when you don't have a free press to challenge
exactly.
that, then
exactly.
That's all
they hear. They hear one side of the story. So they think that, I guarantee you that, you know, the Turkish population, which unfortunately has only a government-controlled press to listen to, only hears the government side of the story.
And it's not just Pastor Brunson
right.
that's imprisoned. Turkey's hostage diplomacy goes beyond that.
Right. So among those that have also been detained other than Pastor Brunson, including a NASA scientist and other various U.S. embassy workers. So, you know, it's not just a U.S. pastor. And I know that, you know, you'll see the tweets from Vice President Pence, you know, talking and emphasizing, you know, an American pastor has been detained. But, you know, I think it's important to highlight and to note that, you know, other American citizens have been detained, and they've been detained around the same
right.
time.
Mm-hmm. Or employees of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. going after everybody under trumped-up false charges after the failed coup attempt. And not only American citizens. There are two Greek soldiers mm-hmm. who were falsely detained. They accidentally crossed over into Turkey. The weather conditions were bad. They didn't know what was going on. And instead of doing what is the normal custom, which is, okay, totally, we realize that, you know, there's not a red line on the sand that you sometimes, you know, accidentally cross over, Turkey has been detaining them. And, you know, people say, well, the courts are the ones that are detaining them, not Erdogan. Let's not, you know, kid ourselves here. There's really no difference between the Turkish court system and Erdogan ever since he right. fired tens of thousands of judges and appointed his own loyalists into those positions.
We'll get more on all of this with our upcoming interview with Michael Rubin. So stay tuned for that up next. We're pleased to be joined this week on the Greek Current Podcast by Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a former Pentagon official with an expertise in the Middle East and Turkey. Thank you for joining us, Michael, and we look forward to this discussion on Turkey and the sanctions imposed by the U.S. on two Turkish ministers this week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the discussion, Thanos.
So the Trump administration imposed sanctions against two top Turkish government officials under the Magnitsky Act over the detention of Pastor Andrew Brunson, a U.S. citizen. Give our listeners a brief overview of the Magnitsky Act and what specific measures are being taken against these Turkish officials.
Well, very quickly, the Magnitsky Act is the successor to the Jackson-Vanik Amendment of the 1970s, which was directed to tie U.S. aid and foreign policy to human rights in the former Soviet Union. Now, when the Jackson-Vanik Act expired, it was named after Magnitsky, who was a Russian human rights defender, anti-corruption crusader, who was killed. Recently, the administrative Congress had expanded the Magnitsky Act to go beyond simply Russians and formed a global Magnitsky list. And this is to what the two Turkish ministers have been added. Basically, it's symbolic. It simply, if they have bank accounts in the United States, those would be frozen. It makes it illegal for Americans to do most financial dealings with them. But it's more symbolic than anything else. But while Turkey and Turkish officials are reacting with outrage to this, you know, they're two Turkish ministers, and yes, they had a role in imprisoning Andrew Brunson. But on the other hand, they're not initiating this action. The action's been being initiated by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And so in some ways, the United States is stopping short of doing anything that would be more than symbolic and truly effective, because let's face it, Turkey is now a dictatorship. Erdogan calls the shots, and to pretend that two lower ministers in the cabinet, the interior minister and the justice minister, actually initiated this without Erdogan is foolish.
So to put it in a broader context then, do you view these sanctions
placed on these officials as impacting Turkey as a whole? I know we've seen the Turkish lira take a hit, but do you see it resulting in any shift in behavior from Ankara?
Well, at this point, no. I mean, Ankara's pattern is to respond with outrage, to dig in its heels. What will be curious is to see what happens in the weeks to come, whether there's any quiet diplomacy that results from this. They are very, very targeted sanctions. You can't have sanctions that are more targeted than simply going after a single individual's financial holdings only if they have them in the United States. That said, what we see with the Turkish lira and its decline past the psychological benchmark of 5 to the dollar is it is having a broader impact because people collectively are starting to recognize that President Erdogan's policies, his economic ignorance, and his willingness to interfere in the free market make investment in Turkey very, very risky.
Ultimately, then, like you said, this is symbolic. We shouldn't expect our Pastor Brunson release in the upcoming weeks. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think eventually he will be released. Turkey wants to bargain. What I think has caused the reaction in Washington is that there appears to have been some secret dealing behind the scenes in which a Turkish activist who was arrested in Israel for supporting Hamas would be released, and in exchange that Andrew Brunson would be released. Now, when Turkey says we can't control the courts, what the Trump administration sees is basically a bait and a switch because no one trusts the Turkish courts.
Right. And like you said, the decisions are made by Erdogan at this point.
Exactly. And so one of the key impediments to any sort of quiet diplomacy is that we tried to work with Erdogan. It didn't work. I was having conversations with some journalists yesterday who were saying, isn't this rash? Isn't this going to cause a Turkish reaction? But we need to remember this wasn't plan A. This was plan B or plan C. No one in the United States wanted it to come to this. But at the same time, we're not going to sweep this sort of thing under the rug when it comes to hostages. And, you know, it's not just about American hostages. Several Greeks are being held hostage as well. And the fact of the matter is, until the international community steps up and says, this is not a path you want to go down, this is the path which only a rogue regime like North Korea or Iran would go down, Turkey's not going to change. There has to be a red line drawn.
You mentioned these hostages. Obviously, you said it's not just Pastor Brunson. Turkey has made hostage diplomacy a centerpiece of its foreign relations, and we've seen it, as you mentioned, with the two Greek soldiers that are currently held in Turkish prison without charges. There are other U.S. citizens that have been targeted, State Department employees. Why do you think Turkey is doing this ultimately, and is it backfiring?
Well, ultimately, the reason why Turkey is doing this is because Erdogan believes that bullying works. And to Erdogan's credit, in the past, bullying has worked. What Erdogan wants is for people to acquiesce to his political demands. And his political demands may have to do with, for example, Fethullah Gulen, the exiled Turkish theologian who's who's been living in the Poconos in Pennsylvania in the United States. And they may have to do with any number of other demands. There's two problems with this, first of all. If Fethullah Gulen was guilty of staging the coup, then he should be arrested. Turks haven't provided any evidence that's credible in any way to U.S. authorities. And, you know, this isn't moral equivalency. U.S. courts are far more independent than Turkish courts are. The second problem here is that there's been a pattern that when you give in to Erdogan's demands, he learns the lesson that he can simply increase his demands for the next crisis. And again, that's not a pattern in which we want to fall into.
By all means, this situation is unprecedented and it's evolving between two NATO allies. I know you've done work on NATO as well. What does this mean for the NATO alliance? And do you see it pushing Turkey further away from the West and into Russia's arms?
Well, first, let's tackle the Russia issue. In Washington, I listen in on a lot of discussions and I'm part of a lot of discussions. And those who honestly think that we should take a softer line on President Erdogan and Turkey say, look, Turkey is a member of NATO. It has the second most men under arms of any NATO country. after the United States. They were with us during the Korean War and so on and so on and so forth. And they will also say that Turkey is very transactional. And so this is just normal Turkish diplomacy. Instead of looking for an ideological friend and ally, we need to realize that we have to barter. Now, here's the problem with that logic. The whole point of NATO is collective defense in the time of crisis. When there is a real crisis, we want to ensure that all the NATO countries come together to counter that crisis. Not that countries see this as an opportunity to get into a bidding war between the United States and Russia. And so fundamentally, there's very little trust when it comes to Turkey and Turkey's role in NATO. But here's the problem, Thanos. In NATO, NATO is a consensus-driven operation, which means it's not a matter of voting 29 to 1. The 29 countries have it over the one. The fact of the matter is that Turkey could be a Trojan horse, which prevents NATO's functioning, which then leads to the question, why not just expel Turkey? And this is the second problem, that there is no mechanism inside NATO to expel a country. Now, in the past, when there's been very serious disputes with Greece over Cyprus, for example, and also with France in the past, both Greece and France have withdrawn from the command structure of NATO, but they did it voluntarily and they did it temporarily. They weren't expelled from NATO. So in a situation like this, the worst option wouldn't be Turkey leaving NATO. The worst option would be Turkey flipping towards Iran or towards Russia and then deciding to stay in NATO.
I'd like to get you to elaborate a little bit on that, because when you mentioned this Trojan horse, the role that Turkey could play, I know we've raised the alarm about Turkey's purchase of the S-400s from Russia and simultaneously its desire to get the F-35. What would that mean for NATO and for the West if Turkey had both the S-400s and was able to acquire F-35s as well?
Well, I mean, the danger is basically the leakage of intelligence. Now, if Turkey was going to integrate the S-400s into any of its air defense systems, that would mean bringing Russian engineers in and exposing code, exposing operations, that sort of issue. When it comes to the F-35s, we've seen the leakage of intelligence already from Hakan Fidan, the Turkish head of intelligence and so forth. When in fits of pique, he's exposed spy networks and so forth operating in Iran or American forces and their equipment operating in Syria, that sort of thing. With F-35, it's our latest, it's our next generation fighter. I just came off a ship that was carrying them, and watching them in operation was just astounding. I mean, worlds above the F-18s, which I'm used to seeing and interacting with. At any rate, stealth technology, all sorts of new capabilities. Now, on one hand, there's a fear that, you know, in a fit of pique, Turkey could say, we're going to allow Russian or Chinese inspectors and engineers to go over these airplanes and to look at them. On the other hand, you could simply have an incident in which, as Turkey is working with the Russians, as Turkey has the S-400s, that S-400s could be used to track the F-35s, not to shoot them down. I mean, these are Turkish S-400s and Turkish F-35s in theory, but rather to allow the S-400s a better opportunity to figure out the tactics and how to counter the F-35s. I mean, ultimately, we're talking about not only American lives at stake, but also Greek lives at stake and all other members of NATO. You know, the only corollary I can think of in recent history was the sheer and utter outrage that occurred about, maybe it was about 15, 20 years ago, when the Israelis had decided that they were going to sell some technologies, I think it was a radar system or something, to China. And ultimately, they backed down under tremendous pressure. But the attitude in Washington, the Pentagon, and I was in Washington at the time, was if the United States is ever going to fight a major conflict, it's probably going to be with China. And so why would you give technology to a country which ultimately could use it against Americans? That's the attitude in Washington. And that's what Turkey's, the attitude which is now driving the questions about the F-35 sales to Turkey. But just one quick point, Thanos. Mm-hmm. What worries me about this is that the Senate is tying the F-35s just to Pastor Brunson. And the fact of the matter is that the concerns about Turkey should be much broader than just Pastor Brunson. I wouldn't want to see, just because Pastor Brunson is released in theory in the future, that suddenly Turkey gets its 100 F-35s, because the broader problems with Turkey's relationship with Russia, with Iran, and elsewhere goes far beyond one man.
Right, and that gets to the next point that I wanted to touch on as well. As you were talking about the F-35s and the S-400s, we've recently seen the House pass its final defense bill that had stipulations that clearly set out conditions in the case that they needed a report, for example, from the proper governmental authorities on Turkey before any transfer of F-35s could take place. Do you see the sanctions that were currently put in place this week as building off of that movement, or is it separate?
I think to some ways it's separate. The analogy I would make is, if you've got a bucket and water is slowly dripping into it, you can ignore the fact that there's a flood or a leak going until that bucket starts to overflow. We're at the point where we have had a drip, drip, drip of problems with Turkey for the past 15 years. And some people have been prone to ignore it or to dismiss it. But we're now at the stage of the flood, and there's no longer denying just what a serious problem we have. And that problem has gotten only worse since President Erdogan has implemented the executive presidency. So even those who were still putting some faith in Turkey's democracy no longer have any ability to say, well, we can work with parliament, we can work with opposition, because frankly, the CHP, the IYA, the HDP, they simply don't matter in Turkey anymore.
You argued some months ago, and I want to come back to a point that you made, where you mentioned that you think it's a mistake that they're tying the sale of the F-35 to the release of Pastor Brunson. You actually argued that sanctions under the Magnitsky Act were necessary against Turkey for, among other things, its crackdown on free speech and its jailing of journalists. Do you believe that these sanctions now that we have in place will actually give the U.S. the leverage it needs to hold Turkey accountable for other human rights violations as well?
Well, ultimately, what we have here is a graduated strategy in which this really is a shot across the bow. There's plenty of other Turks whom we could sanction up to and include. Look, I mean, frankly, Erdogan's son-in-law should be sanctioned. The former oil minister turned finance minister should be sanctioned for his support and his financial support and profiting off of the Islamic State. Erdogan could be sanctioned for any number of other issues. Basically, the reason why I was focusing on in that Washington Post article on journalists and so forth is journalists are really the canary in the coal mine. And with regard to freedom, with regard to other issues, and Erdogan, well, what worries me, and I'm sorry for going all over the place, but what worries me in Turkey right now, and the reason why is focusing on the journalists, is this. We can talk about these very real problems right now, the F-35s, Pastor Brunson, but the problem which the United States is going to be facing, Greece is going to be facing, and indeed the entire region is going to be facing into the decades to come, is the aftermath of a brainwashed Turkish population. Erdogan has said he wants to raise a religious generation. There's nothing wrong with religion, but he confuses religion with Islamism, and it confuses the traditional more Turkish Sufism with Saudi-style Salafism or Muslim Brotherhood style Islam, and that's going to be a big danger. When we look more broadly, you know, Saudi Arabia sponsored terrorism through the funding of extremist mosques for generations, starting in the 60s and 70s with the oil boom, continuing into the 80s and 90s, and indeed past 9/11. However, over the last decade, the Saudis have started taking seriously the need to crack down on this sort of thing. And unfortunately, it wasn't because of 9/11. It was because Al-Qaeda and other radical groups started striking inside Riyadh and Jeddah themselves. But while Saudi Arabia is now coming in from the cold, what we see with Turkey is replacing Saudi Arabia in a way as the driver of global extremism. I have a collection back home. I'm speaking to you from Kansas, where I'm lecturing at Fort Leavenworth, but back home in Washington, D.C., I have a file of all these news reports from the Netherlands, from Switzerland, from Austria, from Germany, from Belgium, from France, from the United Kingdom, and so forth, of Turkish state-funded imams who have been guilty of either assisting terrorism or spying on dissidents and so forth, or promoting radicalism. We also have that sort of issue happening increasingly inside Africa. The fact of the matter is Turkey's becoming a sponsor of extremism with global reach. That's what we should be worried about. And that's why we need to worry about the fact that 15 years of incitement have taken a deep toll on Turkish society.
It's not a very bright prognosis for Turkish society.
If I may, Thanos,
but yeah.
I mean, some of your listeners may know, most probably don't, that I'm married to a Soviet refugee, and my wife tells an old Soviet joke about the difference between a Soviet optimist and a pessimist.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet pessimist is the one who says, you know, things have never been as bad, they couldn't possibly get any worse. And the Soviet optimist is the one who says, no, they can always get worse. So I'm afraid that in this situation, when it comes to Turkey, I'm like a Soviet optimist.
Well, I mean, we obviously need to be alert and paying attention. And the issue with journalists and the jailing of journalists is of serious concern, as you said, that they're canary in the coal mine. I want to reel us back a little bit. We saw in the aftermath of the sanctions that Turkey vowed to retaliate. In the climate that we're seeing, like you mentioned, in Turkey, where the information is obviously controlled by Erdogan, there is no, you know, journalism that can really give a different view, and people are left with, you know, one source of information. They're going to believe whatever that source tells them. So what kind of response do you think we should expect to see from Ankara?
Well, what I worry about is some of the American personnel down at Inderlik and rogue or vigilante action taken against them. There's some precedent for that. After the 173rd Airborne Division intercepted a rogue Turkish Special Forces unit in northern Iraq back in 2003, we've had subsequent problems inside Turkey where Turkish nationalists or those incited to Turkish nationalism will attack American sailors, for example, on Navy port calls in Turkey, to the point where the U.S. Navy has canceled most of its port calls inside Turkey because it can't guarantee the safety of its sailors anymore. Turkey's going down the path where Erdogan's personal temper tantrums or political expediencies trump any sort of notion of rule of law. And if the Turkish government goes after American business property or Trump personal property inside Turkey, all that's going to mean is that people are going to stop investing in Turkey. And already Turkish investments in Turkish are rated as junk by most rating agencies in the United States.
You mentioned that they're having trouble keeping Americans safe that are stationed in military bases in Turkey. Is there any discussion or any insight that you have into, from your times at the Pentagon, from your contacts there, that there's a reevaluation of maintaining presence in those in Inderlik, for example?
Well, absolutely. You know, we have for the past 10 years, and this transcends administrations, it's not a Republican or Democrat thing, been working with Romanians to build up our presence at Constanza, which is on the Black Sea, which is becoming a major U.S. Air Force base and resupply base. That could help bypass the need for the Inderlik Air Base. Likewise, a few years ago in Jordan, we have our annual or our biannual military exercises, I think called Eager Lion. We flew in F-16s into northern Jordan, and quietly we've left them behind. On top of which, you know, the United States is increasingly grateful to Greece for the use of Souda Bay in Crete, which we use to help supply many of our ships going in the 6th Fleet and into the 5th Fleet. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if we have to pull out of Inderlik, if we have additional ships that are paying port calls at Souda Bay in order to resupply, so simply so that we could have based off our ships, not based in Greece, of course, but based in our ships, our F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, or if it's an aircraft carrier, our F-18 Hornets and so forth. Ultimately, whereas 15 years ago, we didn't really have a plan B, now we have a plan B, plan C, and plan D, So we're not as reliant on the Incirlik air base. The other thing, of course, which worries American policymakers is Incirlik's the storage of nuclear weapons in Incirlik. And I think we're going to see that quickly come to an end, although I don't have any specific insight into that. That's just supposition.
Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us this week. It is a great conversation, and I really hope to have you back on with some more updates in the future.
Anytime. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you again.
The word of the week is galosini, which means kindness. So we're going with our theme of, fundraising and the GoFundMe campaign and, everyone expressing their kindness, right? The the waiters in Greek Islands restaurant, the other restaurants and that have been donating all their proceeds or, what portion of their profits too. So we want to recognize everyone for their galosini.
Yeah, unbelievable displays of, like you said, galosini, philanthropy. From everybody, whether it's from the Greek community or our neighbors. So again, thank you to all the donors and everyone who stepped up. We haven't done these in a couple podcasts, but we want to do a quote of the week as well. And we found a quote from the ancient Greek philosopher Sophocles, aptly named, I think. And his quote is, always desire to learn something useful. What do you think, Georgia? Is he onto something?
That's why we have this podcast, right, for you guys, so that you can learn something useful. He's definitely onto something.
Right. Knowledge is power. So
there you go. Yeah. Knowledge is power. And I want to make sure to highlight all the restaurants as well that were part of our philanthropy day. Obviously, there was Greek Islands, Greek Kitchen, Avli Estiatorio in Winnetka, Platia, Artopolis in Greektown, and Canella. So if you haven't visited them yet, make sure to visit. And thank you again for all the work that they put in to make this Philanthropy Day possible. And for our New York and New Jersey listeners, gather your friends on Saturday, call Nerai Restaurant, and know that every dollar spent will be going to fund relief efforts in Greece for the wildfire victims. On that, I want to thank you guys all for joining us. Nick, Georgia.
Thank you.
I expect you to be here. No. And tune in again next week for the next episode of The Greek Current. Thanks.